7 of Breaking Kayfabe with Dodger and Barry. A very special episode, if we will, here, Barry, because I'm not in almost any of it, which means the ratings should go through the roof. What we did here, folks, I've had a kind of a tough week, and so Barry had his very special guest that he wanted to have on the show, and at the last minute, you're going to be noticing me having some audio problems here as I've been hiccuping, burping. I don't know. I got some kind of side effects from the medication I'm taking, Barry. Barry reached out to friend of the show, Gabriel Daigle, who turned his car on to go back home so he could record, Barry.
How amazing was that? So in a nutshell, Jeff and
Here's me in a nutshell.
In a nutshell, it's about 4:22 in the afternoon. We're scheduled to record at 5 o'clock with our special guest based out of LA. And I call Jeff, and Jeff gets out about 4 or 5 words, and then there's this pause. So I notice it a couple of times, and Jeff says, for the last few days, I felt like shit, reaction to medicine, maybe something going on. But, you know, I was like, well, there might be another solution. He says, if you can do it, do it. So we call Gabe Daigle, and you've known Gabe for 30 years. Jeff, I've known him for years. He's a wrestling fan, but he's also a punk rock and new wave aficionado. So I call him and I'm like, Gabe,
now, do we need to clarify what is the difference between punk and new wave and ska?
I will leave that up to our friend based out of England, John Lee, who can certainly go ahead and give us a clarification. But I call Gabe and I'm like, Gabe, are you free in 38 minutes? And Gabe goes, I explain what? And Gabe goes, well, I was going out to lunch. Let me turn my car around and go home. So we do want to thank him. If anything, Jeff, when it comes down to interviewing, I acquiesce to you. You take the lead because you're a fantastic interviewer. So there was no way I was going to go into this interview solo. I did need somebody there. So Gabe was, you know, just great in a pinch. He was like, I'd love to do this. And turned the car around, went home. We got Sweet Lou, and we recorded what I think is a pretty interesting segment.
So why don't you give the folks our guest name and, you know, maybe first glance, you won't recognize the name, but if you go a little deeper, it's somebody you know.
Yeah, absolutely. His name is Xander Schloss. I may say to you, Xander Schloss, and you may say, I have no idea who the hell that is. However, Xander Schloss not only played a key pivotal role in my favorite film of all time, which was Repo Man, which we've discussed, you know, 40 dozen times. This guy is also a member of the Circle Jerks, which is, in my opinion, one of the top 5 punk rock bands in the history of punk rock. And he's played with Thelonious Monster, The Weirdos. He worked closely for years with Joe Strummer. And this was after Joe Strummer left The Clash. So this is somebody that has a pedigree that is 8 miles wide, 8 miles deep. He is a legend in the punk rock community and obviously is an actor. This was a guy that I've been trying to get on the show forever. So, you know, I don't know if our people are going to take to it, but he is really interesting. He has got a really great story to tell, and he's really open and engaging. So I really enjoyed this conversation. I missed you, Jeff. I think it would have been a lot of fun. But again, we're super grateful for Gabe to being able to jump in.
Okay, so why don't we now go to our interview with Xander Schloss and have a little fun with Gabriel and Barry.
So we are real fucking excited this week. First off, we should say, too, that we want to wish Jeff the best. Jeff not feeling great this week. There's no setback or anything like that. He is making incredible progress as he battles cancer. But the chemotherapy will kick your ass a little bit. And I spoke with Jeff less than an hour ago. And Jeff said, man, I don't know if I can record today. And I said, you know, I think I've got the guy that could kind of, you're not going to be able to fill Jeff's shoes for a couple of reasons. First off, Jeff has huge feet, which isn't going to happen. But I know a guy in LA that's a good friend of both of ours that is a punk rock aficionado and historian and a good friend. And I immediately called him and let's welcome Gabe Daigle to the Breaking Kayfabe with Baldrin and Barry podcast. Gabe, thank you for filling in for Jeff today. Thank you for being my co-host. It's the first time I've actually ever done this in 2.5 years without having Jeff. But I'm excited because you and I, we're great friends. We love food. We love professional wrestling. And we also love the Los Angeles music scene, whether it was that late 70s into the 80s punk rock or even the new wave scene that KROQ made famous. You and I, we really share a lot of this, Gabe.
Absolutely. Thanks so much for having me, Barry. I really appreciate it. I'm sorry that Jeff's down. Boy, I've been through that with my dad. All blessings to Jeff. I love the guy, and I'm so sorry that he's not doing well today, but I feel very fortunate to be able to talk with both you and our guests.
And our guest.
Yes.
Exactly. So we have a guest, and this is not, I got to say, when I reached out to him and he said, I would love to do your podcast, immediately I wet myself. It was like immediately I had to call my wife. I'm like, you're not going to fucking believe this, but I've got a legend, because musically this guy is a legend. And look, the word legend gets thrown around. Am I right, Gabe? A lot of people use the word, but if you go through his resume, this is a legend. But and the other aspect of this is, and anybody who's listened to this podcast, you know, over the last 2.5 years knows I referenced the movie Repo Man at least once an episode, whether it was the music, whether it's the movie, or the fact for me, it was a way of life in a sense back then. We've got somebody that was an integral part of the movie Repo Man, starred in the film, had a fantastic role in the film, but also went on to work with the director, which was Alex Cox, numerous times. So I think we should, you know, after all this now, after all this buildup, we should welcome, we have with us a member of the Circle Jerks, a member of the Weirdos, a member of Thelonious Monster. We've got Xander Schloss with us today, Gabe. Xander, how you doing, my friend?
Just about as good as a guy could do during this very, very strange and challenging time.
Gotcha. So with that too, how has your life, obviously, and I know that the Circle Jerks were supposed to be going on tour this year, 40th anniversary of the group Sex on the tour 2020, it's been canceled. But you know, other than that, how has this affected you personally?
Well, that being said, you know, we were supposed to start a world tour that would have lasted throughout the rest of 2020 into 2021, and going to some places like Japan and Australia and some places that the Circle Jerks had never been before, back down to South America and Mexico City. And yeah, I was pretty excited for that. I had actually been working with the personal trainer for about 3 or 4 months and dropped 45 pounds and shaved my beard and cut my hair, because nobody wants to see an old long-haired fucking hippie bearded guy up there playing punk rock. Or maybe they do. I don't know. I can't assume what people want to see. But at any rate, so I can't help but say that at first when this thing came into public consciousness, I was like, oh, and I was told that the tour would be canceled. And I thought, oh, what, for a month, for a couple months until fall? Like, I was like, good grief. I'm like the Charlie Brown of rock and roll. And like, you know, I can't do anything right. Like I selfishly took it personally and was like, oh, this just is another chapter in my life where I'm like a rat that jumps on a burning ship, and instead of a rat that jumps off a burning ship. And it's all my fault for having no sense of direction, having no sense of intuition, like what, you know, what to do. It's like, another missed opportunity.
But so, Xander, are you saying you're responsible for the pandemic? I mean, are you taking full responsibility
no.
for this? All right.
I'm saying that was my first thought. And of course, you know, people will say, well, everybody's going through it. And I'm like, well, that doesn't help me, you know, to know that everybody's going through it, because I'd kind of rather just be like tripping on my own, like, and just freaking out on my own. And people could just say, well, you're paranoid. And I could say, well, maybe that's the truth. But this thing that I've been thinking for my entire life is that there are unseen forces that we are powerless to do anything about that are, you know, coming to get us. You know what I mean? And they're like, more specifically, coming to get me. And people say, oh, you're just paranoid, Xander. You're crazy. You know what I mean? And so does it help me to know that I'm not crazy? Does it help me to know that everybody's going through it? Well, you know, I feel bad because I really have a lot of empathy for everybody. And it's like, I was talking to somebody the other day and it's like saying it's like a worldwide earthquake where it's like when you're feeling the effects of this giant earthquake, you can, you know, see somebody in South America ducking under a desk, you know, if you're on FaceTime with them, you know, and that's, to me, that's pretty scary, you know, to know that it's like, you can't run, you can't hide, everybody's going through it. Does it make me feel any better? No, it makes me feel terrible that everybody's going through this.
Xander, this is Gabe. I would echo that sentiment. Part of what, you know, I'm 56. This is definitely the weirdest time I've ever lived through. I've got 10-year-old twin girls and an 18-year-old boy, and I'm here working for the most part. And I have my wife as well. But yeah, it's, you know, to be working at home for the last 2 months, it's just, it's incredibly surreal. If I can pull you back real quick, we were talking about, Barry was asking about the 40th Circle Jerks tour for the Group Sex album. I know that you weren't there at the start with the Circle Jerks, but when Group Sex came out in 1980, where were you on your musical path?
Oh, I mean, I graduated from high school in 79, and I was living with my jazz teacher. A lot of people used to make fun of me, like when I initially got into the punk rock scene, because I had lived with my jazz teacher and was transcribing Charlie Parker and John Coltrane solos and practicing my arpeggios and my inversions and, you know, all my, you know, minor seventh dominant, you know, augmented, like, just literally like a student of music and sure. Like to the nth degree. And then I went to music school. So I think in 1980, I had stopped living with my jazz teacher and being a house painter and moved up to Los Angeles to go to music school. And by the time I had gotten to music school, I had already been taught everything that they were teaching in school from my jazz explorations. And I basically came to Los Angeles to kind of get into the competitive stream. I didn't want to be a big fish in a small pond. I wanted to be a small fish swimming with the rest of the fish.
Right.
And in the hope of, you know, finding an opportunity to make albums and tour and play live shows and the stuff that you do as a professional musician. So I found myself actually meeting this is going to really date me. I was playing Donkey Kong in a 7-Eleven.
We all relate.
And I noticed that the cashier had a set of drumsticks behind the cash register. And I said, oh, you a musician? He said, yeah, I'm a musician. You a musician? I said, yeah. He said, well, what kind of music do you play? And craftily, I was like, oh, I'm not going to answer this question. What kind of music do you play? And he said, I play funk. And I said, oh, really? I play funk too. And, you know, he said, well, why don't you come down to practice with us tomorrow, you know, down in Inglewood, and we're going to play a show tomorrow. I said, okay. So he gave me directions to his place. I got lost. I got there at the end of the rehearsal. They were packing up the car and saying, oh, don't worry about it. Just come to the gig. And I'm driving along. And now, you know, this is an African-American guy, and the rest of the guys were African-American guys. And I'm driving along, and I see these big steel towers. I'm like, what the hell is that? And
Oh, my God.
We turn in. It's the Watts Tower Festival.
Yes.
We're down in Watts. That was my first gig in Los Angeles, and I got up on stage, and I played without having any rehearsal in front of 5,000 people. And people were not too happy to see me there, you know what I mean? Some little nerdy white boy up there. But But at the end, everybody was patting me on the back and saying that I did a great job. That started my 2-year-long stint in playing gigs down in Compton, Watts, and Inglewood area with a band called the Juicy Bananas.
Eventually, is this the Juicy Bananas who did Bad Man from Repo Man soundtrack?
Yes, that is a song that I wrote with the Juicy Bananas. Well, oh, I didn't write the lyrics. The lyrics are from Alex Cox from the script, and Cy Richardson, who plays Repo Man in the movie, he recited those. It could be cited as like, you could say it's spoken word, but this is pre-rap, you know what I mean? So, you know, with the musical backdrop. But yes, that's the Juicy Bananas. I originally met Alex when I went to music school up here. My stepsister was in UCLA Film School. And so I used to come down there with flyers saying, I will score your student film for free. And I started scoring student films down at UCLA Film School, and eventually met Alex Cox, who was about to go on, you know, he was a graduate student and about to graduate into, you know, doing feature films. So, you know, Alex and I became friends, and he originally wanted me and the Juicy Bananas to just do music for Repo Man. And once he started getting around me and saw what a character I was, he kind of started writing the character of Kevin the Nerd around some of the things that I was going through, working these menial little jobs, you know, like grocery clerk. And, you know, I actually live with Alex, you know, in the back of a sausage factory for free. And we would stuff sausages for basically to pay the rent. And I'd come home and I'd bring Alex groceries that I'd stolen from the grocery store that I was working in. And I think that he just sort of like was seeing like just this character sort of evolving of this fresh faced, like kind of pimple faced kid who had these like kind of weird, like aspirations of becoming top of, you know, whatever grocery store that he was working at, like a manager, you know, in 2 years or whatever. So, you know, I think that he kind of loosely created the character of Kevin the Nerd around some of the stories that I would bring back to him. I know I'm jumping all around, but it's just like,
no. Yeah. And we love that too. So you mentioned it, it's really funny. So that Bad Man, which it, to me is such an amazing song. Born in Chicago, raised in the city streets. My mama gave me the basic facts of life. And I reached out to Cy Richardson a couple of years ago, and I was just so curious about that song. And he basically told me the first question I asked was, did they actually take the lyrics from the movie, or did you have to go in and record? And he said, no, I actually went in and I had to record. So it was kind of spoken wordish, as you said. So that's interesting about how you got cast in the film. I had heard a rumor that the role of Kevin almost went to the late actor Christopher Penn. Was that true?
Yeah, that is true. And, you know, I don't want to go too long-winded about it, but yeah, they cast me as Kevin the Nerd. The producers and Alex came to me and they said, we've got great news for you. We want you to play the character Kevin the Nerd. I was working as a PA. Alex had given me a job as a production assistant on the set. And so I went out and I was getting, you know, costume stuff. And like, I was really, really psyched. And at the end of the day, I came back to the movie set. The producer sat me down. They said, unfortunately for you, but great news for us, we were able to negotiate with Chris Penn's agent, and Chris Penn's going to do the role, not you. And my answer to them was, well, yeah, well, fuck you. You know what I mean? I am Kevin the Nerd, and I'll fucking show you.
There you go.
And I went home that night, and I know it sounds ridiculous, but I think that I'm responsible for the faux hawk. I know I sound crazy, but I went home and I thought, what would be funnier than like kind of coming back with a mohawk, you know, like Travis Bickle style, because I wanted to present myself as being unhinged. I thought, well, what would Kevin the Nerd do? Kevin the Nerd would want to be like considered a punk, but not punk enough to like completely shave the sides of his head. So I gave myself a faux hawk and came back to the set the next day and started to live the character of Kevin the Nerd, even though they had given it to Christopher Penn. And I was there. I was watching Christopher Penn film his scene that I was supposed to do. Then it was my job as a production assistant to bring the film into a viewing, you know, a place where they would view the dailies. They're called dailies. And I was standing around the corner as Michael Nesmith of the Monkees was the executive producer, and Alex Cox were viewing the dailies with Chris Penn. Michael Nesmith looked at Alex, and I heard him say, "Alex, this is terrible. You know, what are we going to do?" Not to take anything away. God bless you, Chris Penn. He became an incredible actor, but he was very young. And Alex said, "Well, you know, I had originally wanted to cast my friend Xander Schloss as Kevin the Nerd." And Michael said, I heard him say, "Let's give Xander a shot." And so I knew, but they didn't tell me for the next 2 weeks. I continued to work as a production assistant. And the day after my 21st birthday, they said, "We have great news for you. You are going to play Kevin the Nerd." And I was like, "That's right, motherfuckers. I told you so. I am Kevin the Nerd." What, and so then I had a star on my, you know, old? On my trailer, and I didn't have to pick up cigarette butts and run errands anymore. And like, you know, I nice. Was transformed into a movie star.
Wow. You were 21 years old?
Yeah. The scene in the grocery store was shot the day after my 21st birthday.
Wow. And that, which is essentially the opening scene of the movie, at least for you and Emilio, which is, yeah. So what was your relationship like with Emilio? Were you guys able to bond at that stage, or was he a very focused actor that, you know, he wasn't socializing? How was Emilio on that set?
No, he was cool, man. It's like me and him were around a similar age, and, you know, we just bonded as I was working as a production assistant. You know, he and I were bonding. In fact, he was at my 21st birthday party, along with people like Linda Blair. And I was like, "What is going on here, man?" It's like I've come to Hollywood, and now I'm like surrounded by these weird people. So me and Emilio had kind of formed a friendship, and that kind of informed, I think, that first scene, because that was the first, that grocery store scene was the first time I'd ever been filmed acting, the first time I'd ever attempted acting. And I got to say, it's like, I think what helped me a lot is that I've always been kind of an extrovert and a performer and a class clown. And, you know, people say, "Well, how do you do that?" I was like, "Well, you just got to not give a fuck about the fact that there's 50 crew members and other actors watching you and a director looking right at you while you're doing this stuff. Make the faces, say the lines, hit your fucking marks, and that's it."
That is it, too. So my favorite actor of all time, again, this is something I've droned on about, was Harry Dean Stanton. And I fucked up, and I say this all the time, that if you ever have the chance to interact with somebody that you admire, if it's a hero of yours in any, you know, whether it's an athlete or an actor, musician, don't pass it up, because tomorrow never comes. And I had the chance to meet Harry Dean Stanton about 3 years ago when the documentary on his life was being played in New York City. I live right outside of Philadelphia, and I was going to get on the train. I was going to go up to New York, and my lazy ass just couldn't do it. And of course, Harry has since passed away. You got to have a great Harry Dean Stanton story for me, Xander.
Well, I don't know, man. It's like, you know, Harry also was, I mean, these are just guys to me. I never gave a fuck about celebrity. And, you know, I think that may be one of the reasons why I was able to jump off and play with like people like Joe Strummer and, you know, the Circle Jerks and stuff like that, you know, and I was never really affected by stardom or celebrity. And Harry was just a guy who, you know, like I'd bring my guitar to the set, and me and Harry would play these like kind of songs that he sang in Spanish, and we would jam out and sitting in the trailer. And, you know, Harry was always really nice to me. I know that he could be quite difficult if you crossed him, but I really don't have that many Harry Dean stories to tell because Harry was quite lovely to me. I don't have anything bad to say about
him. No, and I definitely don't want to hear anything bad about Harry. But just hearing that you were actually, you know, doing music with him about these Spanish songs that he had written, that right there is a great Harry Dean Stanton story, because to me, he's like a raconteur. Harry, you know, was around forever. His career goes back to the 50s, and literally he had his hand in everything at one point or another. Another person that you worked with a few years later on the movie Floundering, which we can also talk about, was Olivia Barash.
Well, yeah, Olivia was also on Repo Man. I think she played Layla, but she was 18 years old at the time that she did Repo Man. And when I was working as a PA, it was my job to kind of like pick her up and drive her to the set and drive her home. So we became friends on Repo Man. But it was part of my duty as a production assistant to pick up Fox Harris, who played J. Frank Parnell, the lobotomized nuclear scientist. And not to jump off of Olivia, but like we really bonded. I mean, he was quite a weird guy, like a great character. In fact, I used to put on my acting resume that just to piss people off that Fox Harris was my acting coach. Fox couldn't drive. And, you know, as a result of that, you know, these relationships that you form, I eventually was in the script. I did scenes with Fox Harris. And so we developed sort of a rapport together just as two guys, which helps to inform the scene as well and the chemistry there. And Alex, when we did, I think, extras for the Criterion release of Repo Man, asked me to do kind of like a little skit as J. Frank Parnell. I don't know if any of you guys have seen that, but I did a pretty spot-on imitation of him. I don't know if you've seen this, but Alex interviews Sam Cohen, the actual inventor of the neutron bomb, and there's some other extras where Alex and I are hanging out, and I'm playing the part of J. Frank Parnell in the extras. I think it's for the Criterion
yes, collection that's right.
release.
But yep.
And Alex has recently told me that if there is going to be a Repo Man sequel, that I'll not only be playing Kevin the Nerd as a, you know, I don't know how well old Kevin would be now, but also I'll be playing the part of J. Frank Parnell. So I'll have two roles in the sequel of Repo Man.
Wow. And you were in, I know there's the unofficial sequel, which is I Repo Chick, and you were in that as well, correct?
Yes, I was. And, you know, it's funny because, you know, that movie was a bit of a cartoon. And I think that Alex is a true agitator and rebel and punk rocker. I think he kind of did that. It was a political statement and it's kind of a, you know, just like to do things on a ragtag budget in a soundstage with a green screen and all those kind of toy trains and stuff and statement on the housing crisis and the banking crisis and all that kind of stuff. He really does thumb his nose at a lot of things that, you know, I don't know. He's a pretty rebellious and political guy. You know, Alex was, before he went to UCLA Film School, he was studying to be a barrister at Oxford University. And Alex is not only like rebellious and an agitator, I love him to death, don't take this the wrong way, but he's dangerously intelligent. You know what I mean? So, he can go out of his way to really, you know, kick up some dust and start some shit, you know?
That's, and you know, I think you can see that in a lot of his films too, not just Repo Man, obviously, but Sid and Nancy really is a work of art. The last name I want to ask you about when it comes to Repo Man is really because I think I stayed awake a lot of nights when in my youth, and maybe even now, I don't know if I'm going to admit that, but Deborah Balgobin, she was like,
Jennifer.
She was the hottest thing. She was the hottest thing to me.
Jennifer,
you know,
Balgobin.
Jennifer. Yes. She was the hottest thing to me, you know, just whether it was the way she smiled, you know, I had the biggest crush on her. I'm assuming I'm not alone in that, though.
Well, Jennifer is a lovely person, and you know, she's incredibly beautiful and exotic, and she's one of the first hot punk rock chicks I've seen, because there's a lot of not hot punk rock chicks. I don't mean to like be a dick or anything, but like, you know, that's like you know, when you see like the new version of hot punk rock chicks, Suicide Girls and stuff. I think that Jennifer Balcoban really informs all that kind of like tattooed, hot lipstick wearing, like mohawk, you know, hot punk rocker chicks. And she is a lovely human being. It's actually Jennifer. I don't mean to jump off of this, but Jennifer and this other guy, Walt Cronin, who was working as a still photographer on the set, they drove up in a car, not unlike Repo Man, when I was living in an office space on Hollywood Boulevard. And this is, you know, after the release of Repo Man, and I'd fallen far into, like, you know, trying to be an actor and living in my car. And then I eventually got a space for $100 a month, 10 by 10 space with no television, no bathroom, no kitchen, brick wall outside my window that I'd have to, you know, roll out my bedroll at night, and then in the daytime act like I was in an office. You know what I mean? And so I was kind of walking out of the entrance of the Palmer building. It's on Hollywood Boulevard between like Ivar and Cosmo, and counting pennies to buy a burrito down at the burrito stand down the street. And a car pulls up, and it's Jennifer Balcoban and Walt Cronin. They said, "Hey, man, the Circle Jerks are looking for a bass player." And I'm like, "Well, why the fuck are you talking to me, man? I'm a guitar player, you know what I mean?" And they're like, "Hey, kid, looks like you could really use a job." And I thought to myself, "Huh, I really could use a job." And so I called up Greg Hudson, you know, and so Jennifer is basically partially responsible for motivating me to call the Circle Jerks, who I'd met on the set of Repo Man, but they totally were like, dismissed me. I was like, "Hey guys, hi, I'm Kevin the Nerd. I play Kevin the Nerd. My name's Xander." And they just walked right by me. But at any rate, so I called him, and Greg said, "Well, we want you to learn three songs and come in and audition." And I said, "Oh, okay, three songs. Well, fuck you guys. You know, with my jazz training, I'll learn all three records and come in and fucking blow away the competition," which I did. And you know, out of 50 guys, at the end of the day, maybe they were just tired of auditioning people, but I got the gig. And they asked me at the end of the audition, like, "Why do you want to be in the Circle Jerks? Why do you want to be in punk rock?" And I said, "Man, I've been playing with this band, the Juicy Bananas, down in the, you know, Watts and Compton area, you know, playing funk." And I said, "You know, I just don't think that I could ever make any money, or black music is never going to make any real money. I want to join the Circle Jerks and be in punk rock because I want to get rich."
Yeah.
And they looked at me like, they all laughed. They're like, "You must Wrong. Be the dumbest fucking guy in the world. You're fucking hired."
Oh my God, that's hilarious. Yeah, boy, going to enough punk gigs over the years in the early 80s, man, I wouldn't have thought there was much money in that either.
Yeah.
I have to tell you, Xander, as you and Barry took part in the Repo Man Love Fest.
It's a love fest. It is a love fest, Gabe. Yes, absolutely.
It's quite obvious. I already know that on your part, yeah. Barry, but I can't even believe it. I have never seen Repo Man. It checks off all the boxes. Everything you talked about, Xander, I might as well have just gone straight to a TV and watched it right now, and I think I'll be watching it tonight. I don't know how that one slipped under my radar, but it sounds like a blast.
Well, do yourself a favor, Gabe. I'm just kidding.
I'm gonna do myself a favor, absolutely. If nothing else, I'll just be looking for you, Xander. Oh my God, I just love hearing your attitude when you first just tell them, "Hey, fuck it, I'll learn the whole damn catalog." And then you go in and you do it, obviously, and you've been playing continuously with them since that time, Xander, since the mid-80s?
Well, yeah. I mean, they've had several other bass players before me. You know, they had originally Roger Rogerson, and then Earl Liberty was the bass player just before me, I think. Or I think maybe even Flea filled in for a stint. But Yeah, I'm the longest running. We've been on the hiatus for the last 10 years, but
yeah.
You know, but yeah, I don't know, man. Like Repo Man, I got to say, you know, out of all the things that I've ever done in my strange and fragmented career, I never thought any of them were really, really that special or something that I should really take note of, because someday I'm going to grow up and be some sort of like punk rock historian, or like, these are like golden times that I'm going to have to reminisce about. And nobody would have ever thought that a band of misfits, like, you know, would ever have such a pervading effect on pop culture, you know, worldwide. But it affects everything now, you know, fashion, and, you know, advertisement, everything. Out of all the things that I've ever done, and I've paid very close attention to choosing things very wisely that I thought would have integrity. Repo Man, when I read the script, it's got so many memorable lines. And Alex is such a special director, and the cast of Repo Man had such a camaraderie, which shows, because Alex took a lot of those actors and formed a troupe that would carry on through, you know, the other films that he was doing. But at any rate, I thought to myself, this movie, this thing that we're doing, is really, really special. And I don't say that about anything. I'm very, very critical, and I'm very, very keen to say that, you know, hey, not much of any of this stuff, anything, is important. But I thought Repo Man was an important film, an important mark in time, and would become some sort of like cult classic, you know, even before it came out. And honestly, on the release of Repo Man, it got shut down as a theatrical release, like 2 weeks into limited theatrical release. Mm. But I will say this, on the basis of the soundtrack, which included such bands as Black Flag, Circle Jerks, you know, Blotty Blotty Blah, Fear, it was the first film probably that had a compilation of bands that would go on to actually sell the movie. And upon the success of the soundtrack album, the film was re-released theatrically. So, and that would be a forerunner in people creating these buzz bin sort of soundtracks that included, sure, you know, various artists of the times to help to promote and sell films. And so he was, you know, Alex was a pioneer in a lot of things that are currently happening now with films.
I'll tell you what's interesting too about that too. So when the movie was released, it, and even though you say that it was basically the legs were cut out within a couple of weeks, I saw it, and you and I were talking about this off air, and it made a big difference for me. I was 20 years old. I was kind of had a punk attitude. I had not a lot of direction in my life. And I saw the movie on a rainy afternoon in New York City at the 8th Street Playhouse. And it wound up playing at the 8th Street Playhouse for something like 8 or 9 months. It developed literally this cult following. But when I saw the movie, I walked out and I was like, fuck. Like, I think it was like somebody had just slapped some sense into me, or just the opposite. But I walked out and I felt almost empowered by seeing the film. Literally within a block of me exiting the movie theater, Iggy Pop is walking down the street. And it was almost like this sign from God. Like, you know, you just saw this movie. It's got this amazing theme song by Iggy Pop, and there is fucking Iggy Pop walking down the street. It meant so much to me. But guys, I want to circle back. You said something, and this is actually for both of you. You said something about, you know, right off of Ivar, that you're, I guess, living right off of Ivar. Do you guys remember in the mid-80s, the Ivar Theater?
Well, it's funny you should say that, because when I did get into punk rock, I met the whole cast of characters in Los Angeles during those, now I think, golden times. You know, it was a very lively time in Los Angeles history, and maybe the last real cultural revolution. But at any rate, I befriended a guy named El Duce from a band called The Mentors.
Yeah.
And that was an unlikely pairing, me being a skinny kind of, you know, pimple-faced nerdy kid, and El Duce, who was the genre of music that they, you know, don't get offended, anybody, but they used to call their music rape rock. And El Duce was working at the Ivar Theater, running the lights when it was a strip club.
Yeah.
And
wow.
I'd go up to the booth with El Duce and hang out with him. And I took El Duce to parties as well, to just to agitate people and stir people up. Cause he'd say stuff like, please don't take this the wrong way. I know we're in a different era. Women are slaves. He just like burst out. And then he'd like pull his dick out and take a pee on somebody's leg. You know what I mean? Just like he was fucking insane. You know, but yeah, I remember the Ivar Theater very well. El Duce would come up to the Palmer Building and we'd hang around and talk, and with his friend Red Dog and this other guy, Zimmy the Skinhead, you know, and you know, Zimmy didn't know that I was Jewish, but and I'd like, you know, drive Zimmy over to Errol Flynn, you know, that little broken down park back there where Errol Flynn's estate was. Yep. I'd drop him off and he'd just walk up into the park and to sleep out, you know, out in the open.
El Duce was a, too, just, and I never saw him live, but I've seen videos. That was one bad motherfucker. And that was a guy you wouldn't mess with. But it's amazing about the Ivar. If you go back and you look at the history, this was a building that was putting on professional plays and musicals and getting the biggest names. And then somewhere around the late 70s, it got a new owner. It became really seedy and it became, as you said, a strip club. And I lived out in LA in the mid 80s. And whenever my friends would come in from out of town, I grew up in Florida, we would go to the Ivar. And what made the Ivar so unique above everything else was the atmosphere. It was almost frightening being inside when it was a strip club, but you could, in the 80s, you could actually take photos of the strippers. And there, I don't think there was another strip club in the United States, maybe even the world, where that was permitted. So I showed up there. I think it was like Sunday nights or something like that. And they would encourage you to take photos of the strippers. Now, obviously, that's everywhere. That kind of shit's everywhere. But that was a really, really, really big deal back in those days. So, you know, the fact is, I love Repo, man. Gabe's got homework tonight, Xander.
Yes, he sir.
He is going to watch Repo Man. He's going to give us a full review. He's going to understand why it's my favorite movie. So I think definitely Gabe and I want to circle back and start to get into the LA punk scene that you were a part of. But were you a fan of the LA punk scene prior to entering into the punk scene?
No. Like I said, man, I was like, you know, transcribing Coltrane and Charlie Parker solos. And like, you know, I was becoming an accomplished jazz guitarist and student of music. And this is something that really fucking bums people out when they hear me talk about it. It's like, man, when I heard the Sex Pistols for the first time, I was like, those guys don't know how to fucking play their instruments. This is just, it ain't Led Zeppelin. And it, you know, they can't rip like Jeff Beck or Jimi Hendrix or any of these guys. I was into like the guitar heroes, the guys who could really, really play their instruments. And I'm just like, you know, what makes you people think that you could just pick up an instrument and do what I do? You know what I mean? Fuck this.
They're punks. Fuck this. That's why they thought they could do it.
Yeah. Fuck right? This whole thing. You know, like, I mean, I can remember having the feeling of listening to Bob Dylan and Neil Young just playing solo with their acoustic guitar. And I had the same feeling that a lot of people express when they first heard punk rock. Well, shit, they could do it. So I could do it. And I'm like, that it was that for me with people who were solo singer songwriters, because I was like, oh, they're playing the guitar and, you know, singing, you know, lyrics and melody. And that's something that's accessible to me. I could hear what they're doing and I could imitate that. You know what I mean? Yeah. You know, I mean, as far as punk rock was concerned, like I literally, you know, and I worked with Joe Strummer for several years as his musical director and guitarist, but Joe was mainly interested in my curiosity and my passion for all types of music and blah, blah, blah. But at any rate, listening to The Clash, you know, when I first heard the first Clash records, I thought, this is just like, you know, basic stuff, a garagey kind of simple sound. So I literally like went through Sandinista backwards. And I realized that The Clash had developed as a band not unlike the Beatles or the Rolling Stones, from very simple beginnings and getting into, like, say, Sandinista would be the White Album for the Beatles, and right. Combat Rock would be Sergeant Pepper's, you know what I mean? Or, I mean, London Calling, you know what I mean?
Yes.
And I saw that they were very musical, and they were exploring different styles of music from pretty much all over the world, you know, real musicologists, and incorporating other instruments like horns and guitars, and Lee Scratch Perry doing some dub stuff on there. And I was like, wow, this is a really musical band. So that's what it took for me to start to even consider punk rock as a real sort of form of art. I'm not a punk rock cop, and I hate it when people are just like, well, that's not punk rock, or this is not punk rock. Who gives a fuck? You know what I mean? My attitude may be punk rock, and my lifestyle may reflect a bit of the ethos, however you want to pronounce it, of punk rock. But really, it's like, if a song is crafted well, and it's a well-written song and well-performed song, I don't care what genre it is. You know, it could be English, Scottish, Irish folk music, or some people beating on drums in Zimbabwe or something. Dude, sure. If it's good, it's good.
Yeah, you know? I think you would find that both Barry and I are very much like that as well. I'm big into progressive rock, and it doesn't matter what a genre of music you like. There's snobs in every genre, and they're calling you out if you don't like this or if you're not doing that. And I much rather prefer just being open and listening to all sorts of different stuff.
Well, yeah, and you know what? Joe Strummer was the same way, and he admired that about me as well. If you really kind of look at what Joe's saying about punk rock, he's never talking about a style of music. He's talking about an attitude.
Yeah, you know? Yeah. Well, and as you already pointed out, too, it's so reflected in the Clash's discography. And I'm sure Jeff's going to be very happy to hear all of this talk about the Clash, Barry, because
Clash are
actually one of Jeff's favorite bands. But yeah, there was such a variety to it. I love stuff like that where you can listen to like 10 or 11 cuts on an album, and there's just, you know, instead of it just being a story with one narrative, it's the music is just taking on all sorts of different styles. And the Clash is like a perfect example of a band that they went all over the place in the time that they were together.
Yeah. And, you know, you had some very musical bands in Los Angeles back then, too, like X and the Blasters. You know,
you can't say enough about X right now, Xander. I mean,
that
new album that just came out, Barry and I we're just salivating over that new album.
Yeah, and it's great, you know, and it harkens back to what they were doing back then. And it's just like, dude, that was what kind of like really solidified it for me. Was that back then, it was like anything goes. Everybody was welcome. There were no punk rock cops or judges and juries. Everybody was welcome. Women were welcome, like, you know, the Bags. And
the friggin' Go-Go's. It's hard to believe. I mean, people would, if they didn't look before Our Lips Are Sealed, they would never believe where the Go-Go's came from.
Yeah, and, you know, to me, it's like now when you're looking back and people are talking about punk rock, it's no wonder that like the Bad Brains come up as one of the greatest fucking punk rock bands of all time. And those guys were African-American and really, really fucking incredible musicians. So I don't think this thing of like this non-musicianship thing of, you know, even Lucky Lair had a background in playing jazz drums. And like, listen, if you listen to the Circle Jerks, dude, there may be some primitive qualities to it, but we play fucking lightning fast, turn on a dime, stop and start, and it takes a huge amount of dexterity and stamina and accuracy to play that stuff, you know?
Lucky. I don't know currently, obviously, because I haven't seen the band in ages, but holy crud, that guy was like a machine gun back behind the kit. Just amazing.
Yeah, and he was informed by jazz, you know, and it's like, wow. I knew a lot of drummers, like Keith Clark, for instance, when Keith and I were playing, I knew that one of his main influences was not only Mitch Mitchell, I mean, not Mitch Mitchell, what's his face from the Who?
Keith Moon.
Oh, Keith Moon, right.
But also Buddy Rich, you know?
Oh, man.
So it's just like, dude, you carry these things forward into what you're doing. There's nothing that is not without influence from other music and other periods of time. Like I say, if it's fucking great, you know, add it to your cachet of, you know, influences and tricks.
I'd have to agree with that, too. I'll tell you a good example of that as well as Fishbone. Fishbone has been all over the map. They did heavy metal. There's a lot of ska and reggae influence, and some punk as well. I'm a huge fucking Fishbone fan.
Yeah, and those guys were around during that time. Dude, I was kind of like almost grandfathered into the punk rock scene, and I met all the cast characters immediately, like, you know, the Red Hot Chili Peppers and Fishbone and Jane's Addiction and the bands that really made a statement about Los Angeles back then. Not all of them were considered to be hardcore punk rock. You know, I met Black Flag and all those guys too. Stan Ridgway from Wall of Voodoo. It was like a pastiche of all different styles and all different levels of art. You know, the weirdos, I wouldn't even consider them necessarily, even though they probably were the first punk rock band in Los Angeles, even though it's not documented. They all say it's the Germs. But they were basically an art rock band, you know what I mean? And very, very weird in their choices. They never even proclaimed to be punk rock. They said they were weirdos from Hollywood, you know? In saying that, it's like when I start to hear like all these bands that sound exactly the same and following the rule book, it's not about following the rule book or conforming. Punk rock is doing something contrary and something unique. And, you know, that's kind of like what I'm doing with my music now. You know, if people say, well, it doesn't sound like punk rock, well, it is fucking exactly contrary to punk rock. It's slow, it's gentle, it's beautiful. It's still very, very biting in its lyrical content, but not in a political or socio-political way, but in an emotional way. And it's like, dude, who's to fucking say what punk rock is? Where I come from, and I know because I was there, it was all about originality and uniqueness and doing something contrary to the flow of what was going on.
Right. A lot of what you're talking about throughout this interview has to do with the attitude rather than the music itself.
Yeah, and listen to what Joe Strummer has to say. I dare you to find him talk about, you know, music when he's referring to punk rock.
Right. So let me ask you this, Xander, because you brought up the weirdos and you brought up Stan Ridgway. Barry and I are both huge Wall of Voodoo / Stan Ridgway fans. To this day, Wall of Voodoo is the only band that I saw on successive nights back in 1982. I loved Wall of Voodoo like nobody's business. And there is that tie-in, and I'd like to know the hierarchy or the timeline, as it were. I know you played with the Weirdos. I know that Bruce Moreland, who was the bassist for Wall of Voodoo, played with the Weirdos as well. And as Barry was informing me earlier, and I had forgotten, you actually recorded with Stan as well, right?
Well, yeah. I mean, for the Floundering soundtrack. And, you know, this is going to maybe tie it into the whole Palmer Building, you know, living in the office thing. Up right. On the fourth floor, I used to go up to the roof and stuff and throw water balloons off the roof of the Palmer Building. I'd go up there and I could hear there was a rehearsal room up there, and behind the door I could hear somebody go, Bing fell down, Bing broke both his legs. And it was Stan Ridgway and Wall of Voodoo. And I'd see Stan out in the alleyway. And, you know, another band that used to rehearse there was a band called Guns N' Roses.
Wow.
And you know what I mean? It's like Stan and I became friends. Stan is a really musical guy and a real contrary to kind of what was going on. I think he's more influenced by Johnny Cash than he would be like say, for instance, John Lydon or something like that, you know?
Sure, sure.
But at any rate, yes, I did. And I played some music with Stan on the Floundering soundtrack. Yeah, great guy. Really fucking sweet guy.
You know what's amazing, Gabe, when you just said that? There is only one artist I've seen on consecutive nights, and that was actually Stan Ridgway. He was in, yeah, amazing. He played a venue in Philly. Geez, I think it was 2007, and I was so taken with the show. It was a very emotional show for me because he really is just an incredible musician. That the next night he was playing in Hoboken, I got in my fucking car, I met a friend up there, and I saw Stan. And so this was interesting, and I think this is another guy that you know. Stan was having drinks. It was a place called Maxwell's in Hoboken, and it's a bar and restaurant on the first floor, and the bands play in a basement. Seems like the biggest fire trap you've ever seen.
Oh,
there's like one way in and one way out, but I walk in, I'm like 2 hours earlier, we're drinking, we're getting something to eat, and Stan is sitting at a table. So immediately, you know, like the fan in me gets really excited. So I tell the bartender, the waitress, buy a round of drinks and just say it's for me. So Stan walks over and he says, thank you for the drinks. He says, would you like to meet a friend of mine? I said, absolutely. Brings me over. And who's he sitting with? And I didn't recognize the guy. It's Peter Case from the Plimsolls.
Oh, yeah.
So immediately I'm like, you know, like, again, the 10-year-old schoolgirl inside of me is fucking bursting out. And I'm like, I got Stan Ridgway and Peter Case, and they've invited me to sit down. It was absolutely huge. So it was a big deal. That Floundering soundtrack, though, I really enjoy the movie as well, but I really like the soundtrack. You and Stan did a great job on that.
Oh, thanks, man. Yeah, you know, it's funny. Peter's a nice guy. Everybody was really fucking super nice. There wasn't any of this, like, kind of, like, tough guy attitude, you know? Like, everybody was warm and welcoming and helping one another, like, to, you know, and supporting one another. It's not all splintered like it is now. Now I start to sound like an old man, like, you know, damn kids, get off my lawn, you're trampling my flower bed. But, I mean, that's what happens to us, you know what I mean? It's like, cool, you know, and that's a sure sign that you're getting old when you're, goddamn, the kids today, they don't have any sense of community and blah, blah, blah. But, yeah, no, I mean, it's funny. And I was watching Iggy Pop's new punk documentary series, and I realized, like, after watching all four episodes, dude, punk rock was a very, very small community, world community. And I knew pretty much, I had encounters and had become friends with pretty much 80% of the people that were in these documentaries. I mean, it's like we could talk about the things that we know and that you guys somehow have, through your detective work, seen that I've been involved with and people that I've encountered. But it's like, there's many, many more behind the scenes, and it just made me feel like, wow, this was really a special time and a lot of really special people, and it's very, very small, you know?
I think, too, and Gabe and I, earlier this week, were talking, and we were kind of talking about the differences between Los Angeles punk versus New York punk, and I gave my observations, which basically, in L.A., if you were involved with punk, that was essentially 24/7 for you. It wasn't where, you know, in New York, and this is, and I don't want to offend anybody in the punk scene in New York in the 80s, but there was a big difference that people would go out to punk clubs at night, and the next morning they would put on their suit and tie and go to work somewhere. And in LA, it was 24/7. You know, you had Disgraceland, but you had all these houses all throughout Hollywood and Los Angeles out in the suburbs that were essentially punk houses where people lived 24 hours a day. They played their music. As you mentioned, you were saving pennies to get a burrito. There wasn't a lot of money going around. It was a lifestyle. It wasn't just a genre of music, correct?
Correct, yeah. And there was a lot of squats and a lot of, like I said, a lot of community. Yeah, there was a difference between New York, but it's like wherever we would go, we would find our tribe. Like, you know, there's Joey Shithead up in Vancouver of DOA, or Jimmy Gestapo out in New York of Murphy's Law. And all these people, we shared a commonality and a common thread kind of ran between us. I don't know if you could really put your finger on it, but it just, like I said, it was a small tribe, a world tribe. And you could even, you know, see it over in London. And like, you know, my stint working with Joe Strummer, it's like on any given day, I'd be like hanging out with Rat Scabies. And then Joey Ramone would walk in the room. And man, I feel like I'm dropping so many fucking names. You're going to have to get out the shop back to vacuum them up, you know, or Stig Baders from the Dead Boys.
Dead Boys, yeah.
Right.
You know? And it's just like, dude, everybody knew everybody all over the fucking world. It was like a weird ant colony, and we all had some sort of way of communicating with one another through our antennas or something, you know? Saying that, it just brought to mind, and it was like a weird epiphany that it was really, really small, you know, not to say that anybody wasn't welcome, but there was an insular sort of like bubble. So suffice to say, when I say, hey, man, you know, I would have never thought that it would become such a culturally significant time. It was just a bunch of misfits that I'd run into. And I've played, you know, with every band that's on the plaques now that are considered like classic fucking punk rock bands. I didn't think anything of it, to be honest with you. I just thought it was a bunch of nice guys making a bunch of racket, and that was it.
You worked with, I mean, you know, you look and you mentioned it. Who didn't you work with in that era, in that genre of punk? The Weirdos. And then your career taking off and, you know, working with Thelonious Monster and Bob Forrest, and you guys recorded with Tom Waits. I mean, how was that?
Well, you know, I don't know. Tom wasn't in the studio. I mean, that was, I think, done remotely or something happened. You know, I mean, Thelonious Monster was part of the cast of characters that I met, you know, and I think they came to a place called Fortress, him and Flea, you know, Bob and Flea and Anthony. And then, you know, at the time I was living with this guy who sold Coke. And so we all went and got some Coke together and drank some beers. So I was in, you know, it's like kind of a rite of passage, you know, to do drugs with them. And, you know, I'm 15 years sober now, but I was strung out on heroin for a number of years, and that's an occupational hazard, I guess. A lot of people have died and blah, blah, blah. But yeah, you know, and Bob was a junkie, and Pete was a junkie, and I was a junkie, and Dick Denny from the Weirdos and Thelonious Monster was a junkie, and the guys in the Two Free Stooges were junkies, and everybody was fucking junkies back then. It was a city of junkies, just as New York's Lower East Side back then was a city of junkies. And being a junkie was sort of like, that's part of fucking punk rock, you know?
Yeah. So you mentioned too, 15 years sober. Congratulations on that. Are you doing work now as a drug counselor as well?
Oh, I was until I got laid off at the end of March. And I thought to myself, I'm not going to be affected by this crisis. I'm not going to get laid off because I'm working in a sort of offshoot of the medical industry. And yeah, I've been working in treatment for about 4 or 5 years. Yeah, at any rate, it's like when they start closing down the houses and you got more clients than staff, you got to lay off or furlough some employees. And you know, quite frankly, it's like I kind of miss going in, but I also feel a lot safer sort of sheltering at home. And when I was finally able to navigate the unemployment system, hey, throw in another $600 a week on top of your benefit. And so I'm making more money being unemployed than I am working in treatment right now.
You were talking about the history of punk rock. And to a sense, you consider yourself a historian of punk rock. Have you
Not
read?
Really.
Well, you know, look, you and I have been friends actually on Facebook for years. So I've seen some of your posts. You truly do have a knowledge and an understanding. I'm assuming that you've read the book that Keith Morris did, but
fuck,
have you?
No.
No.
I don't want to hear him talking shit about me.
Have you read the two books that John Doe did, which was essentially all about the rise of punk rock in Los Angeles?
No.
Oh, they're fantastic. So he wrote two books, and it was Fun in the New World. And then he did a second book called More Fun in the New World. You're in both of his books, by the way. But it's about the making, unmaking, and the legacy of punk rock in Los Angeles. And it's fantastic. I was on a plane. I was flying out to Los Angeles. It was last October. And actually, Gabe and I went and saw a show at the Coach House with the former members of Oingo Boingo. And I think that was one of the most fun nights I've ever had, Gabe. But I read this book literally on the plane the entire trip. It was that good.
Well, I got to say, and I'm not trying to toot my own horn, but I'm probably mentioned in dozens of books about this point in time or, you know, whatever you want to fuck call it. But it's just like, dude, I'm not interested in what people have to say about me in their books. And I'm quite fearful of the fact that there may be some sort of revisionary accounting of me and, you know, whatever happened. So every time I have taken the chance to kind of like just skim through one of these books and see what they have to say about me, I'm like, they didn't get it right. They didn't get me right. I don't want to sound like sour grapes because everybody fucking hates sour grapes. But honestly, like maybe partly because of fear or, you know, resentment or regret or, you know, even could be like regret for those good times aren't happening anymore. I strictly stay in the now, and what I'm doing now is of utmost importance to me because I believe that, like I said, there are unseen forces out there that are coming to get us, and the only moment that's important is now. And what you're doing now, I could hang my hat on all this stuff and say, yeah, man, I did this, I did that, and like fucking, you know, I don't have to do anything else. Well, that's not where I'm at, you know. My mentality is what's important is the work that you're doing. And there's no reward for the work that we do. The reward is the work that we do. So don't hang your hat on what you've done in the past. Stay productive. Strive for your potential. Never reach it. In reaching your potential, people will say, okay, he's reached his potential. We're not interested in anything that he's doing now or anything that he's got to say. Because Repo Man was your potential. Or the work that you did with Joe Strummer or the work that you did with Circle Jerks or Thelonious Monster. And it's like, I personally cannot believe that. And I won't believe it. And I won't be put in a box, you know. And you'll see if you look over the stuff, I jump around. Like before the invention of the internet, it would have taken a highly trained detective to track my career. Because I really don't, you know, there's one thread of consistency that runs through it, and it's that I've tried to pick and choose things that would have integrity. And as in doing so, I will say to you that I am not a rich man as a result of the choices that I've made. But there's a few films that are in the Criterion Collection, and there's mention of me in some of these books, and there's, you know, everything that I've done, the thread of consistency is that those bands and those projects have integrity. In saying that, I'm proud of it, but I'm not really interested in what people will revise in their books and say about it. You know what I mean?
Yeah. And I should say, too, I should point out, too, that in the books that and I actually haven't read Keith Morris's book, but the two John Doe books, everything was positive. And for him, it's really about preserving the history because so much of this is going to be lost. If you guys don't share your stories, this shit is lost forever and it's gone. But you said something that kind of touched me right there, where you live in the moment and you're living for now. And quite frankly, you know, over the last couple of weeks, you've released a couple of singles. I was really, and I'm not saying this because you're on the air with me right now, because I said this to Gabe privately, and I said it to you as well, because I shared this with my son. But that your new song, which is My Dear Blue, gets me choked up. There is something to it. You've self-described it as melancholy. It's moody. I mean, the mood is set, but when I hear it, it really touches me. It's not just a beautiful song. It's performed beautifully. And I got to tell you, I don't always get super excited about new music. And that's definitely on my part. That's a fuck up right there. But I don't always hear something that I can connect emotionally with. I heard My Dear Blue, and I would say over the last 4 or 5 days, I probably have listened and watched the video, because that fucking video, it's like almost a Charles Bukowski film. It is a fantastic video, black and white. Director did a great job. I don't know who the director was, but holy shit, this guy captured, in my opinion, what this song is about. How did you come up with My Dear Blue?
Well, the song itself is a basically, it's descriptive of a person that is suffering from sadness and isolation, as a lot of people are now. And this is, you know, not written during these times, but it's addressing and personifying that sadness, or some people will call it depression, personifying it and basically saying, you've never been wanted, you'll never be needed, not by me. And I want to be wanted, I want to be needed, but not by you. Like, in search of human connection and the stuff that's actually important, like connection, love and connection, you know what I mean? And the stuff that really feeds our soul. And, you know, it's my form of punk rock to say these things that a lot of people will be afraid that if they actually say these things out loud, that they'll be called a fucking pussy. And I'll take the chance to be called a pussy because I'll kick your fucking ass. <I'm just kidding. laughs> but it's my form of punk rock to reveal these things that could be considered distasteful to mention out loud. And people are scared. People are all scared and people are all suffering. And people, you know, I have to say it out loud. It's like, it's not my intention to puff myself up and present myself as a tough guy. You know, I think just the opposite needs to happen. And that was the intention of the song, was to portray vulnerability, transparency, and real deep and dark feeling that I have personally. And I think that if you write a song that is so personal and so true and necessary, like the lyrical content, that it has the chance of being considered something that could be relatable worldwide to all human beings. If they drop their guard and they decide that all this tough guy stuff is not working. And it's the anti-punk mentality there that makes the song, I think, really punk rock in a weird way, because it goes against the grain. There's no volume. There's no speed. There's no aggression at all to the song. In fact, it's gentle. It's beautiful. There's a lot of space. It's soft. It's lingering. And there's no anger attached to it. You know what I mean? So in saying that, that's the song, okay? But the video, it was my concept along with the director and the cinematographer. We worked as a trio on this thing. And I thought, you know, I encounter a lot of adversity going out there as a punk rocker who's played in front of thousands of people and turned them into a frenzy, to going out and playing these solo acoustic gigs where I'm quite vulnerable to the judgment of people that are indifferent and devaluing music in general. So, you know, you walk up on stage, you know, with the guitar and they're like, yeah, he could be a bum that just stumbled off the street and he's playing his song. And I discount it because it doesn't have volume in it. So there's no band behind him and blah, blah, blah. So I encounter this adversity where people don't pay attention and continue to, like you'll see in the video, a girl comes up, turns her back on the band, and takes a selfie and then returns to her table only to complete the circle and drawing attention to herself and then drawing unwanted attention from the guys that are sitting behind her, you know, trying to hit on her.
Right.
And it's just this circle of pain, you know, you don't care, therefore I don't care. And that circle keeps going and it's like, I know that there's a lot of musicians that will relate to this video as well that have encountered this, the devaluation of music and live music. And guess what? Here we are today. And this was shot just the day before the ordered lockdown. And we can't go and see live music anymore. And so, you know what I mean? Hey, maybe people got to rethink this thing about, you know, music, because music is not for nothing. It's the most powerful art form in the fucking world. And nobody says, hey, man, when my dad died, boy, that painting really helped me out, or that television show really, like, helped me to grieve the loss of my father. It's always like, boy, that song or that artist really helped me to get through a difficult time. And that's a statement. The video is a statement on that, you know, the adversity that I encounter playing this soft, gentle music to a world of indifference. I want to present a thing that's dark and heavy and say, hey, people, it's time to reevaluate all this toughness and all this kind of like puffing up and, you know, like, hey, I got this. You know what I mean? It's me and my will, and I'll get what I need and fuck the other guy. Well, guess what? There are unseen forces that are more powerful than you that are now presenting themselves. And I don't believe in any of that stuff. You know what I mean? And if I risk sounding not like a punk rocker because I'm not being tough and I'm not being like, I think the toughness and the courage comes from admitting that you're scared and yes. leaning into your fear, developing courage. It can't be developed in any other way than, you know, running up that fucking hill into the fray and addressing the very thing that scares you the most.
Right.
And what scares me is fucking opening up my heart to a world of indifference and being judged for it or made fun of for it. So that's what I'm going to do. And that's what I do with the song, My Dear Blue. I dare you to judge me because I'm trying my best to stay out of the results of what other people think about me and not bring that into my art. Bring my art out there and then release it and go, okay, here you go. Whatever you want to do with this now, it's out of my hands. I'm concentrating on the very next thing that I'm doing and the next song. Then I'm going to pretty much do the same thing and thumb my nose at what a fucking good old punk rocker is supposed to be at the right age of 58.
I just love hearing your perspective, Xander. It's so refreshing, and I relate to so much of it.
All right, Breaking Kayfabers, you heard it directly from Xander Schloss. Go and purchase this, 99 cents. It is an amazing song. I will personally give you a money-back guarantee that if you don't fucking love this song as much as Gabe and I do, then I will refund your 99 cents. Xander, we love your insights. Thank you so much for joining us. For Gabe, myself, and Sweet Lou, please come back and see us again soon, man.
Absolutely.
So Barry, I know that's a guy that you've been wanting to get for a long time. I know you got to be pretty stoked about having had the chance to talk to him.
Yeah, it really was too. And I mentioned at the beginning of that interview also that I was cleaning up the wet spot after he had agreed to be on the show. And it's true. You know, if we didn't have this podcast, if we didn't have a vehicle, I'm not sure that I would have ever had the opportunity to have this conversation with him. And, you know, we go back through the interviews that we've done, Jeff, and whether it was Dory Funk Jr. or Tully Blanchard, Dan Spivey, Stan fucking Hansen, we've had some great legends, professional wrestling legends on our podcast. And I just think, you know, being able to branch out and actually talk to a guy that, again, you know, he's been in some great films, was in Sid and Nancy, was in some other films that Alex Cox directed. But, you know, he's a punk rock legend. And that is, again, in my world, that's a huge fucking deal right there.
Absolutely. So, well, speaking of the world, let's talk as we begin to end the show here. There is a couple things on a sad note that we need to mention over the brutal past couple of days, Barry.
Oh, and Jeff, so, you know, just before we get on, Jeff texts me and it's like, all right, there's another one. Ken Osmond, Eddie Haskell from Leave It to Beaver passed away today. But, you know, you texted me on Saturday, I believe it was, and you're like, Phyllis George died, 70 years old. Beautiful. Beautiful woman. But prior to that, you know, Jerry Stiller, obviously, earlier in the week, Fred Willard. And it's continuing. It's almost like on a daily basis. And we're not, you know, some of these people are older. I get it. But, you know, we're not looking. Phyllis George at 70, you know, probably in better shape than you and I combined, Jeff. So
I would say at this point, that's probably not a risky bet.
Yeah, exactly. I don't know if it's the times. I don't know if it's COVID-19. I don't know what it is at this point, but it's really sad. And it's, Jeff, we've said it a million times. If you get the opportunity to meet, to interact, to see a fucking hero, somebody who's made an impression on your life, grab it, because tomorrow it may not be there. And somebody posted something on our board, and I forget exactly what the phrasing was of it, but, you know, appreciating every moment of your life and appreciating the people around you and appreciating what you do, even if it's something as small as taking, you know, your dog for a walk. And I take my dog for a walk 4 times a day, and I appreciate every walk at this stage. So I can't stress enough, just appreciate what you got, appreciate the people that you care about, appreciate every bite of food that goes in your mouth. Appreciate your teeth, Lou, while we're there. So Lou's having some dental issues right now, and we're recording this, and he's actually off to the dentist shortly. But I think the three of us right now, I'm out of work. Lou has got dental issues. Jeff's winning a battle against cancer. He's not just winning, he's kicking its ass. And I think you've got three guys that all appreciate life right now. I know I do.
Well said, my friend. So about ready to do the go home?
I think this is it, Jeff.
I hope the folks appreciated a little change of pace here from Breaking Kayfabe with Baldrin and Barry. You know, not something we're going to do every week, but, you know, it's a little change up there. You know, instead of going with the high fastball in the bottom of the ninth, Barry with the knuckleball. We'll see if he can, you know, yeah, you like that? Okay.
I do like that, yeah.
There you go. So on behalf of our producer with the aching teeth, Sweet Lou Kippelman and Barry Rose, I am Jeff Baldrin reminding you that Breaking Kayfabe with Baldrin and Barry is a production of the Arcadian Vanguard Podcast Network. And until next week, good Lord, I hope we all feel better next week. Have a good one, folks.